Okay, so every single LA story starts the same way. I know this, but here goes. Back in the day, I'm with my boy, Paulie. And yes, we're heading up to someone's fancy, fancy party up in the hills, right? We get there. And our hostess, she's LA famous. Knows all these former celebrities from the 70s and 80s and such. And I'm not going to expose anyone's business, but everybody you think, everyone that just popped into your head, they're all there. Hanging out by the pool, cocktail in hand, it feels like we're on the Love Boat, or maybe Fantasy Island or something. And Paulie and I, we're trying to play it cool, but we're from the Midwest, so we can't help ourselves. We go around, hey, aren't you so-and-so? Weren't you in that movie with that guy? People from LA would never do this because they're too cool. But the celebrities at the party, they don't seem to mind because maybe they've been out of the spotlight for a while. We're having a great time. And finally, it's late. People are still coming in, but it's time for us to go. We walk out. This guy nods past us. And my boy Paulie freezes. Dude, do you know who that was? Huh? That was the guy who drove the Bronco. A Bronco. Paulie looks at me like, I have lost my mind. OJ's Bronco. Right now, the second most famous man in the world. Right there. And I don't ask who the first is because I figured that part out by now. This is pre-selfie stuff, but we have an actual camera in the car. I run and get it. And Paulie asks the dude if he wouldn't mind a photo. You can kind of tell that actually he would mind. But he's a good sport. Kind of guy that'll do anything for you. Even drive you around town with half the known universe watching. So he puts down his drink. He puts his arm around Paulie. And he does a real smile. A genuine smile. And I click the picture of the second most famous man in the world. Today on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, Infamous. Amazing stories from real people with their name and lights for all the wrong reasons. My name is Glenn Washington. Please, no flash photography, because this is Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Now then, we're going to kick off our infamous episode in Scotland, where one Gavin Bain spoke to our own Julia DeWitt. Snap Judgment.
Can I swear?
Yes. We'll have to bleep it, so don't overdo it. But yeah, if you feel so moved.
Okay, bleep it. You're talking to a Scottish person. That's almost out of my control.
Uno, two, tres, four.
Do you want to just go ahead and introduce yourself, Gavin?
Yeah, I'm Gavin Bain, also known as Brains McLeod, one half of Syllable and Brains. I started rapping when I was a little kid. First song I ever memorized was Snow's Informer. Informer, you know, I can't even totally know how he says it, but I memorized that when I was like a real small kid. So I've always been in love with rap. First day of college, I see this kid at the gates. He's rocking the baggiest jeans, a Ramon t-shirt, painted black fingernails, and his hair's braided. I mean, he's the coolest human that I've ever seen. And that was Bill, who I would come to know as Syllable or Silly. We liked pretty much all the same things, so we decided to form this rap group. We weren't good, but we knew we were going to get good, and so we spent the next 2 years just mastering every discipline of rap, developing our own style, which was this humorous, multi-syllable battle rap style. Then Eminem broke, in 98. As Eminem's success grew, everyone that heard us would start saying, hey, you guys sound like Eminem. And after a while, we kind of took that as a compliment. I see this advertisement on this music site that just reads, are you the next Eminem? And I told the guys and we just smirked and we were like, we got this. We got this. Because everyone says we are. By that point, my sister was living in London, so we took the 13-hour bus journey down to her place, crashed on the floor. And when we got there, man, the place was packed. And there was a queue of Eminem impersonators going round the block, like, twice. Seeing the faces of people coming out of the room just distraught. When we got in, we approached the X spot awkwardly and stood there in front of three A&Rs, the guys who go out and scout the talent. They were just sitting there with blank faces. We must have been rapping for about 30 seconds before I noticed two of the A&Rs whispering to themselves. It seemed like they were trying to hold back the laughter. And when one of them cracked, within seconds it felt like the whole room was filled with laughing gas. And one of the guys was like, oh no, please, please stop. You're killing me. This is hilarious. You know, are you serious? Like, who put you up to this? Did Steve put you up to this? Did Steve put you up to this? Scottish rap, man, come on. This is ridiculous. The older A&R, who had been quiet to this point, leans forward and says, trust me, you will never make it. Come on, man. Don't you watch MTV? Have you never listened to radio? They're never gonna let Scottish rap on Radio 1. I'm sorry, but you sound like the rapping Proclaimers to me. That was the blow that I'll just never forget. And I was getting real desperate, you know, I'd been kicked out of art college. I needed cash. Like, I had a mountain of bills barricading the front door from debt collectors who were keen on coming in and taking all my money. One night, I'm just lying on my bed. I can hear the 80s film, the Michael J. Fox film, Secret of My Success, is on TV. What it's about, it's like a small town boy goes to the city and makes his way to the top of a company by becoming someone else. I'm just sitting listening there, moving my lips along with the film, and I just thought, that's it. If me being me is a problem, I'll just be not me. If they want another Eminem, I'll just give them that. So, I had to become American. I got the accent good enough just to record. Bill took a little bit of convincing, but when he heard the recorded American version of the song Shut Your Mouth, I could tell he just knew it was like, this sounds real now. This plan is gold. The plan was, we'd get a record deal, we'd make a number one hit record, we'd go on TV, come clean about being Scottish the whole time and prove that the system's flawed and that only the pretty and only the crazy and only the marketable get a chance in this world. And we set about we set about becoming American. I would do everything in the American accent. I would talk to my girlfriend in the accent, and she thought that was insane, especially when I spoke in the voice during sex. The voice in my head that I was hearing would be in the accent. Can't really do all the voices now, but like, when you imagine the kind of doofus American cool character, it's always like, you talk out the back of your throat, like, yeah, dude, like totally. You know, like, you talk like Keanu Reeves, like, no way.
No way. Yes way.
We're sitting down in a bar in Dundee, scribbling out a plan to become two badass Californian rappers like Eminem, but more exaggerated, blown out of proportion. We actually made ourselves a part of Eminem's Californian crew. We were the supremely confident, cocky, but lovable Californian wild boys, syllable and brains, and we were not going to take no for an answer. But it wasn't until we actually heard there was this massive showcase happening in Madame Jojo's in Soho, in London. We called up the promoter and let him know what was going down. It kind of went something like this.
Hello?
Yeah, we're Eminem's boys. We're from Cali. We're in town for the weekend. You know, we want to do a show. Now, if you've got a prime slot, then you're in luck, buddy. Because, well, how much do you pay?
And the guy's like,
pay? This is an industry showcase.
Okay, no money. Okay, well, look, here's what we're going to do. You put us on prime, you take care of our travel, and you make sure we got free booze all night, and you got a deal, okay?
And this guy's just on the other end of the phone like,
what?
Yeah, okay, yeah, okay, we're on. See you Friday, turkey.
Hang up on the guy, you know, was like, I think we have a 9 p.m. slot. we just turned up. They called our names and we just fist bumped each other. And that was it. We jumped into the characters and we were like, let's give these people something they'd never seen before. I play with myself everywhere I go. We stormed on stage. We started chasing each other around the stage with props, fake knives, one of us wearing a bra. Someone stop me. This thing's bad for your eyes. I'm half blind. Each song just a crazy concept with an obscene stage show that kind of resembled like a night at the theater if you were on shrooms. Hey, yo, I'll let fly. Shaving my face with a penknife. Porno mag and a six pack. That's my sex life. Even deaf guys say I'm very tight. And Stevie Wonder said I'm one hell of a sight. We came off stage that night and that performance never stopped. The characters we were that night never stopped for 2 years. We went from actively seeking and chasing management to having the biggest guys in the industry calling us. We signed to
the biggest manager,
Jonathan Shallot, and I remember sitting there trying to sound like it's no big deal. Like I forgot who is on the line and what's on the line, and I'm just like, Look, Johnny, John McClane, we don't get out of bed for less than 70 grand. And he just says, deal. And I'm like, what? I dropped the phone. I'm just freaking out. I'm like, why did I say 70? I could have said 100, you know?
I think at that point you realize that our accents weren't actually that good. They were okay. They weren't actually that good. That's just how good at acting the part we were.
Now we had financial backing from a real force in the industry. And this was on. All of a sudden, our plan wasn't even looking crazy anymore. We started living the dream. We were recording every day, doing shows, touring, building a fan base, sleeping with the hottest woman on the planet. One morning, we were coming back off this hellish tour. And as soon as my head hit the pillow, I got this phone call from our management. He was like, dude, good news and bad news. He's like, the bad news is you're not coming off tour. And I'm about to blow up at him. And he's like, wait, the good news is you're going on the road with your very best friends. D12, you're going to get to hook up with Eminem and Proof. And he's so excited. I can tell he's like dying with excitement, you know? But I was like, oh my God, I'm dying. You know, I'm dying with anxiety here. And he's like, the tour starts tonight. Bus is going to come pick you up in 3 hours. Get some rest. I just dropped the phone. I'm just like, we're done for. That's it. We get to the venue and we're trying to act all normal, but I'd never been this nervous. As we got to the stage, they were on stage sound checking. And one of our team's like, dude, there's your boy Proof, man, you know, there's your guy. And they finished and they were heading our way. We were right at the edge of the stage. And at that point, we were at the mercy of the gods, and we had no other option but to do what we always did, which was just improvise. We just get all loud and we're like, whoa, what's up, Proof? You know, Pardo's cracking. You know, we're just like, what was it be like, 2 years? Warped Tour, right? San Diego, yeah! Thank God they played along. Are there maybe just nice people and, you know, didn't want to turn around and be like, who are you guys?
Well, Gavin, really quick, can we stop really quick here? What about the people that it, you know, could have potentially hurt? Because the thing about lying is it can advance your career, but it also potentially puts other people's trust in you. It compromises that, right? Like,
come on, man. It's the survival of the fittest out here, you know? And remember, we weren't trying to make it happen for fans or to release this act to a world and sell millions of records.
we were trying to get into the industry, make a big bang,
and then come clean, you know, and make a point.
But we just got completely caught up with the whole fun of the life.
To us, everything had to be louder, you know, it had to look like we were on personality steroids. You become like you with all the levels put up. It's almost like you can feel the inside of you going, you know, it's like you become the monster all of a sudden. My girlfriend broke up with me because she came down and visited and she just didn't like what she saw. She was like, I hate this guy. And I kind of had to break character after like one night out, and I was kind of like, it's me, I'm still me, you know, I'm just playing the guy, you know. And she couldn't get it. She was like, nah, you love that guy. You're him. You love this guy. It wasn't until that point, but I kind of started to lose my way after that.
As it gradually went on, it was constant paranoia. Like, oh my God, he knew we're done for. This is totally not going to work. You know, so constantly breaking ourselves down.
And when the fund dried up and we attempted to get down to business, it became apparent that we were losing windows to release.
Before long, it's 2 years, and everyone's going, why are these guys not in the charts? Why is this not released? Like, who's dropping the ball?
So we had a meeting set up, and this guy was no joke. He's got a little sticky note that someone's given him of negatives, of reasons that we should be dropped, right? And he starts reading them out. You guys have missed another release window. That's a few now. You refuse to censor your songs. You have a song called which is banned. And his face is just wincing in disgust with everything he reads out.
It was really funny that the things that we created that got us in there were the very things that slowly but surely Sony tried to change.
Well, that was it. We were just shelved with no apparent release date. Bill and I's relationship just got dangerous, and we blamed each other perennially. And that kind of pent-up frustration, that just boiled. One day, we had this crazy, crazy, crazy fight. One of those fights that, you know, you just don't come back from. And the next morning, we left. The things I went through after that were crazy. They were hellish. I was in the darkest point of my life.
I had found confidence, and you would have thought, wow, okay, this person should be able to walk through walls now. But then the bubble burst, and I started to believe that that only happened because I was playing the character. So all of a sudden, I was scared to go back to the boy who was beaten at school and who was a fish out of water, and I didn't want to be that guy anymore. I didn't want to go back and be that guy and then have the failure weighing me down.
So I was still in the character because I didn't know who to go and be again. Then my friend, a close friend, Ivan, got a rare form of cancer. Ivan actually knew who I really was. Myself and a friend threw a benefit concert to raise money for his treatment. And it would be the return of Brains, the Californian rapper, you know, and I knew I could fill a room of fans and industry people and make some decent money for Ivan's treatment. And then it came to the night of the gig. My new band was just about to go on and do our first performance, and I remember hearing that Ivan, he wasn't going to make it. I had this real problem. My band had just walked on stage, and I'm like, I can't stop crying, and I'm frozen at the side of the stage. My band members are playing the song, and they're just kind of improvising, like, why is he not on stage? I turn to my friend Rob, and I'm just like, oh, man, dude, who am I? Who am I going to be? And he said, just be who Ivan knows. Just cut all this crap. Be you. I stepped on stage and I just said, I'm Gavin Bain. I'm not Brains McLeod. I'm Scottish. I felt like there was this unbelievable cage that I was dragging around with me everywhere. And I just felt like at that point that I just dropped the cage.
I did a kind of moment of silence for Ivan, which was the dumbest thing to do. And I think someone shouted out, talk again, say something. Do you know what I mean? And it was like, when I came off stage,
some girls came up and slapped me. Some people came up and was like, after everything we've been through, you do this to me? You've been in my mother's house. You know, like, stupid, like, so, you know? One of my close friends, Dan, who I loved from Sony, came up and was like, what? This is the greatest thing that I've ever been a part of. I wasn't really caring about the bad or the negative. I'm glad it happened. From being told that we would never make it, we've won.
But it sounds like that sort of pushed you over the edge a little bit.
It did, but, you know, you have to experience the edge. I would never have got to this point if it didn't.
And you had to lie extensively to do it, you know, which isn't...
As soon as you hear the word lie, you think we were lying to people. But that's not really... It really wasn't like that. We weren't lying to people. Even the people that we lied straight to their face never walked away thinking, oh, man, can't believe it. I invested time in those... No, it wasn't like that. It was like, we're here to have the most fun, and you're going to love us. You're going to absolutely love us. We're going to entertain you nonstop.
But you are not American, for example. That's like not an ambiguous fact.
Of course. But I would like to consider it like changing reality. Like, so something where I would say something crazy that I wanted to achieve when I hadn't achieved it yet, and I would tell people I'd achieved it because it would create the pressure that I had to then go and achieve it to the point where then I would just go and achieve it. I've done things my whole life that way, like you're going to tour with Eminem and then boom, end up touring with DJ. You know, it's like setting these big things that you need to, because you're going to look stupid if you don't.
But don't you want to just get famous on exactly what you are?
Well, yeah, and that's kind of exactly what I did, because I'm a great actor.
Big thanks to Gavin for speaking with The Snap. Now, Gavin Bain, he is still at it, ladies and gentlemen, but he's back to rapping in his Scottish accent. And you can find all 10, yes, 10 albums that he's released without any help from a big label, but in the Apple Store, or we'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Julia DeWitt with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Just a moment, the strangest fashion advice you will ever hear, and one family's shocking secret. In Snap Judgment, the infamous episode returns. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the infamous episode. Today, we're exploring stories where people do in fact achieve a level of notoriety, but for all the wrong reasons. And our next story, it takes us to some very dark places. As such, sensitive listeners and those with small children are advised.
So I remember when I was 15 years old, looking out the window and seeing my dad's semi-truck pull up in the front of our house. My parents had been divorced at this point for about 5 years. And my dad's visit was unexpected. He wanted to take us out to breakfast that morning. My sister and my brother were really excited to see him. He always brought gifts from on the road and take time to just hear what their needs are and be a proactive dad. When my dad wasn't around, there was a lot of violence in my home from my mom's new marriage.
Melissa's family lived in Section 8 housing, in poverty, so Melissa's dad tried to help out as best he could. He brought home food and money and took them to fun places like the city fair.
So when my dad came, he was essentially a savior to our family. We got a break from the violence in our home. He did have two rules. One, that we wouldn't smoke or steal. He had been caught stealing from a previous employer, and so that's where that wisdom and that rule came from. But no smoking and drugs and no stealing. I really felt proud to be his daughter. So we all gather up into his semi-truck. Once up there, my brother had taken the passenger front seat. And so I sat up there on the mattress, and my sister sat up there with me. My brother and my sister are chatting away. They're trying to catch up my dad. My dad, he looked content and happy to be in the presence of his children. And I hear my brother open up the glove box, shuffling, looking for gum. And while he's doing that, he finds a pack of cigarettes. And he grabs the pack of cigarettes and holds it up in accusation, like, "Are you smoking, Dad?" And my dad looked over to my brother and said, no, those are for my friends. And my brother's like, "Yeah, right. These are not for your friends." He's like, "Yeah, those are for the hitchhikers that I pick up along the way." And we always knew my dad picked up hitchhikers, and I believed him. So as we're going along, we turn a corner sharply. And as my dad did that, this large commercial duct tape rolled out from underneath my dad's pillow, and it hit my left leg. This is a lot of duct tape. So I just put it back in the corner of my dad's cab. And I also wondered when I did that, like, why was it under the pillow? And then my mind kind of justified it as, well, there's not a lot of space and storage in the semi-truck, so maybe that's why it's there.
Melissa's dad drops her younger siblings off at school and then takes Melissa out to a nice breakfast at Denny's. They find a window-side table, order coffee and food, and Melissa's really excited to spend what she thinks is going to be some quality father and daughter time.
We talked about this and that, and then he surprised me by saying that the road has been hard. He goes into the details of him wanting to settle down and how he has met this fabulous woman. Her name is Julie Winningham, and he's eager for me to settle down in this home with her. I was excited to hear that he was dreaming about the future, and I could go into that with him because I was excited to be saved from the violence in my home life. I felt that he really loved me and heard my needs and heard my call for help.
While Melissa and her dad are busy brainstorming for the future, all of a sudden, her dad drops out from the conversation. He looks at her and says,
"You know, Missy, not everything is what it appears to be." And so I look at my dad, expecting him to explain. And he says, "You know, I really want to tell you, but I know you'll tell the police." I just felt sick to my stomach. I thought, what? And so I decided to excuse myself to go to the restroom. I remember breathing heavy into the stall. In my mind, I thought, is this where he's going to tell me about the rumor that I heard in my family about him stealing welding equipment when I was just a young little baby? I didn't want to know because I was afraid that it would be something that would be hard to confront. From the bathroom, I go back to the booth that we were sitting at, and I was happy to see that our food arrived. I was relieved that my dad was willing to drop the previous conversation as well. We went back to just talking about the future, about what we would be doing.
After Melissa and her dad finish breakfast, he drops her off at her high school. Then he's off for another long trucking gig. It would be a while before he could visit again.
A couple months later, my mom gathered us three children at the bottom of my grandmother's basement. I thought she was going to tell us that she had found a place for us to live, that we can move out of this basement of my grandmother's home. I thought that she had big news. But instead, it was something quite different. She looked like she had been crying. She said, "Your dad's been arrested." And my brother, he had the courage to ask, "For what?" "For murder." I just started running and flopped onto my cot and just started sobbing. I'm wrestling between all these thoughts that I have about my dad. I remember him putting me in a blanket and tossing me around. Is it in a game? I remember him taking us to go get our first bikes. But then murder? Like, how could he murder someone? Maybe he accidentally hurt someone and killed them on accident. And then I thought about the cats. When I was six, I thought about him strangling this black cat that we had on our farm property that my brother found. And then I thought about the duct tape and the cigarettes. And then my mind thought, he strangled a woman.
Melissa's mom refuses to give any more details, so they all go to bed, or they try to.
So the next day I go to school hoping it would be a regular, normal day. But I heard my last name whispered in the hallways. Jesperson, and I could hear them like, can you believe that? And then as I would pass them, people would become silent and just look at me. And then I was eager to go to lunch because I could sit with all my friends and I could feel like life is back to normal again. But instead, when I sat with my friends, they all looked somber and said, you know, my mom and dad know about what happened with your dad. And they told me that they don't want you around me anymore. I felt so ashamed.
After school, Melissa takes a bus to the public library to see if she could find out more about her dad's crimes.
So I pulled up the Oregonian paper and found out that it was for Julie Winningham. And then I find out that there's more murders, a long list of other victims.
Melissa's dad, Keith Jesperson, was known as the Happy Face Killer. Only 8 of his murders have been confirmed, but he claims to have killed as many as 160 people. After taking their lives, he would send letters to the media confessing of his crimes. Then he'd sign off with a smiley face.
And I remember reading the print, and it was the family members of Julie Winningham saying, my dad's a monster. My head said, yes, they have every right to call him a monster. And my heart said, he's my dad.
When Melissa finally gets the chance to see her dad for the first time since his arrest, she has so many questions.
Was he sorry? Did he have remorse? I wondered if he really loved me. And I wondered what was real in our relationship and what was not.
Melissa and her family shuffle into the visitor's room. It's divided by a thick plexiglass with phones hanging on each side.
First, I saw this heavily guarded sheriff open up the door, and I see men with their hands cuffed shuffling, being prodded by the sheriff. And it was so startling to see my dad being submissive to another man. My dad sat down and he talked to me first. And he said, Missy, my best advice is that you change your last name. You know, we're not going to have these fun summers anymore. And that you and your brother are going to have to take care of yourselves. And it's going to be just you guys together. You're going to have to take care of each other. Sorry. Just when I go back there, you know. I couldn't believe this was my life. I thought he was going to make my life better. When I left the jail, there was a part of me that still believed that he was capable of love. that he advised me to go into hiding to protect myself. I thought he was still Keith Jesperson, my dad.
Melissa began to write her dad letters. She would also call him and update him about her life.
I would tell him about my grades. I would tell him about the dances that I was going to at school. And also I'd ask him for advice. I really wanted to have fatherly advice and wisdom, just like he used to give me. My father's advice was really good most of the time. I felt like the letters that I received from my dad were a different side of him. Instead of him signing the letter with a smiley face, he was signing, "Love, Dad." Thick or thin, I would still be his daughter and he would still be my dad. Even though he can't physically be there for me, he could maybe be there emotionally for me.
As time goes by, Melissa goes to college, gets married, has two kids, and for 10 years, she tried her best to keep him in the loop. Still, she never mentioned him to her kids. Melissa says that most people won't understand, but she knew that her dad, Keith Jesperson, was a serial killer, one of the worst ones. And still, she also knew that the same man was a loving father.
So my daughter was in kindergarten, and one day she came home on the bus, and the doors opened, and this bustle of children and energy just like shooted out of the bus. And then I saw my daughter coming down the stairs, and she was so excited to tell me about this new thing she learned at school. She was learning about families. And she said, "You know what, Mommy? Everybody has a daddy." She's like, "Where's your daddy, Mom?" I completely froze. And I said, "He's in Salem. He lived in Salem, but I didn't mention in a penitentiary." And then I saw her run off and go play. And in my mind, I thought, what am I going to do? This is way earlier than I thought I would have to tell her. I'm not prepared.
Melissa didn't know what else to tell her daughter. So she visits her own grandfather, her dad's dad, to see if she can find some answers.
And I sat on his couch and I asked some questions about my dad's childhood and about their relationship. And then eventually we ran out of things to talk about. And there was silence. And then my grandfather looks at me and says, "You know, one time when I went to visit your dad, he said something that really surprised me." "Your dad told me that he had thoughts of killing you children." When my grandfather told me that, I went back to the past, back to the time that I last saw my dad at the diner, and now I knew for sure it was just an illusion. Keith Jesperson, that was the gregarious and fun dad, was not two separate beings, a stranger and a loving dad, but he was Keith Jesperson that brutalized and tortured 8 women. I was too stunned to say anything else. And so I said my goodbyes to my grandpa and left. But as I'm heading home, the whole time, his words just percolating and going over and over in my head.
After visiting her grandfather, Melissa stopped. She no longer took his calls, and she doesn't ever plan on taking her kids to visit him.
Yeah, I cut him out of my life completely. Because he was my dad, I thought that I owed him visits. I owed him my time, that he was my dad. I'd respect my elders. But now he's no longer my dad, the man that I remembered. He was gone. If anything haunts me today, it's just the traditions that my dad passed on to me. When I was younger, my dad would tuck me in like a burrito. And my dad was a really good storyteller. And so I keep that tradition alive with my children. The only thing that haunts me about that is just seeing my kids light up. And I think back, oh, when I was a child, I was just as excited to hear these stories when I was with my dad. But I think that's a good ritual to preserve in my life. even though my dad's a serial killer, I believe that my dad was and has a good person within himself when he was younger, which probably would surprise a lot of people, but I do. I believe that people are inherently good. The only evil thing about us is our own selfishness.
So what do you do with your dad's letters now?
Now when I receive letters from my dad, instead of opening them, I would keep them. I didn't care what was in the letters anymore. And if I could, I would have just changed my address and not receive any letters at all. So instead, today I have a box full of unopened letters.
It's interesting to me that you still keep the letters.
Yeah.
Are you planning on reading them one day?
I don't know why I keep the letters in a box. I don't know what I hope to get out of them.
Okay, I ask because you've basically cut them off.
Yeah.
But still, could it be that you're still holding out for something?
Okay, I see it like insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So the letters are insurance to me of not having any regrets. Maybe when he's gone, maybe I will care. So just in case, I just save them. Maybe there might be something I want to read in the future in those letters. But today, there isn't anything.
Big thanks and love to Melissa for sharing her story on The Snap. Melissa now reaches out to other trauma survivors, and to learn more about Melissa and her father, check out her book, Shattered Silence, on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece is produced by Davey Kim, with sound design by Leon Morimoto. Now, we've got some big news here at Snap's Orbiting Hall of Justice Storytelling Headquarters. Yes, because on Saturday, February 27, 2016, we're going to film our biggest Snap Judgment live show ever in beautiful downtown Oakland at the historic Paramount Theater. It's going to sell out. And that's why we're letting you know here first. If you're in the Bay, or you get to the Bay, or know somebody in the Bay, or heard of somebody that knows somebody in the Bay, tickets are available right now at snapjudgment.org. Now, when Snap Judgment, the infamous episode, returns, an adventure in the world's largest department store, and I promise you will not see this one coming. In just a moment, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from WNYC, the infamous episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, we're digging into stories from people whose fame precedes them. And our next story never happened. At least, it hasn't happened yet. Join me, if you would, at the biggest, baddest box store in the land in the middle of the night. Snap Judgment.
Here at World, we put your shopping experience first.
There's a finger in housewares.
I don't ask what she means. I can't think of anything funny to say. I can never think of anything when I'm talking to Janine. Because I'm in love with her. I'll check it out stat.
Stat?
Come on, man. None of this really matters since I don't have a chance in hell with her anyway. We work the graveyard shift at Worldmart, biggest store in the human world. We're open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. For 8 hours every night, there are two of us in here minding the store, which is roughly the size of three city blocks.
Did you know that Worldmart?
Take a left at the towel racks. It's right by the slow cookers.
You weren't kidding. That's definitely a finger.
I told you.
We should tell HQ.
I don't know. You call headquarters if you want to. I just want it to go away.
Okay. I go back to where the finger is. I pick it up and put it in my vest pocket.
Sign your family up for a family plan. Technology.
Where'd it go?
In my pocket.
Ew.
Sounds like it's in toiletries.
Oh my God. Do you see that? Is that a woman? A zombie woman?
Janine? But Janine's gone. I turn and see her flat out sprinting toward power tools, and now I'm alone, face to face with this woman. Zombie woman. She's older than Janine, closer to my age, maybe early 20s, missing a bit of her face, but otherwise sort of pretty in a melancholy way. Pretty zombie lady holds up two different tubes of lipstick, one blood red and one that's more of an earth tone. And then I understand. She wants my opinion. I step back, look at her skin, which I guess is sort of a grayish baloney color, and point to the earth tone tube. That one. Matches your blouse better. She's holding the lipstick in her right hand, which has a hole where the ring finger should be. I pull her digit out of my pocket and offer it to her. She takes it and jams it into the hole, and then sort of nods as if to say, thanks.
I'm in firearms. Stay low.
She's not going to hurt us.
What are you talking about? She's gonna eat us. She's gonna eat our brains.
No, I don't think so. That's not what she's doing here.
Then what is she doing here?
I think she's getting ready for a date.
What?
Wait, she's heading over to video games.
What's happening? What's happening?
Our friend just discovered Red Dead Redemption Undead Nightmare. Gotta go.
Okay, hang on. I'm on my way.
Hey, it's okay. It's okay. Hey, calm down. It's just a video game.
I'll shoot you!
Janine, stop!
She's a zombie, you idiot. She's gonna bite you and infect you or something. Isn't that how it works?
No, look. I know this sounds crazy, but she's not gonna do that.
How do you know that?
I just know. Just put the gun down, and we can figure this out. I put my hand on top of Janine's and slowly lower the gun. Her hand is warm and full of blood. Hey, would you like to see a movie on Thursday?
Are you asking her or me?
Looks like she's already seeing someone. I'm asking you.
Well then, yeah, I would like to see a movie on Thursday.
Cool. Whatever flicker of awareness I might have seen behind pretty zombie lady's eyes a moment ago isn't there anymore. She turns and drags herself toward the exit, and then, with a whoosh of the automatic double doors, she's gone.
Thank you, pretty zombie lady, for helping our man find the courage to ask Janine out. Justin Carter was our narrator. Melissa Bernias was the pretty zombie lady. And our own Eliza Smith played Janine. That story comes from Charles Yu's collection, Sorry, Please, Thank You. And for more information about Charlie and his amazing writing, visit us at snapjudgment.org. That piece is produced by Eliza Smith with sound design by Pat Macedi Miller. It's about that time, but don't you worry. Just subscribe to the amazing Snap Judgment Storyific podcast and get your fix anytime, anyplace, your way, snapjudgment.org. Hit up Snap on Facebook or Twitter to get the story behind the story. Snap was produced by myself and the team that will live in infamy. The guy who drives my Bronco down the freeway, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich, Pat Steve Miller, Anna Sussman, Joe Rosenberg, Julia DeWitt, and Nancy Lopez hate the paparazzi, but David Kim, Renzo Gorio, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, and Matt Ducat think they're cool. Jasmine Aguilera breaks a tie. Now, did you ever convince someone to steal a cop's gun? Well, if they did it, it's their own fault, not mine. I'm talking to you, Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But much love to the CPB. And surely, you're aware that this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact,
You could wake up to a zombie apocalypse. What about trying to save the neighbors before realizing that the neighbors, oh no, the neighbors look delicious. And you'd still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.